Oh yay. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you. Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Fourth Circuit. We're ready to hear argument on our first case, New Singular Wireless versus Fairfax County. Mr. German?
German.
Sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd be glad to hear from you.
May it please the court, Hans German for the appellant, New Singular Wireless, doing business as AT&T Wireless. Now, this case raises important questions about the limitations placed on local zoning authority by Section 332 of the Telecommunications Act. The first issue concerns the requirement under Section 32 that local zoning decisions denying permission to construct wireless facilities be supported by substantial evidence contained in a written record. Now, the court has previously found in the Virginia Beach and other cases that local opposition can sometimes amount to substantial evidence that supports a permit denial. But here the district court took that idea and ran with it, holding, among other things, that a petition opposing the proposed tower, signed by 47 residents, was substantial evidence that the tower would be aesthetically unappealing and inconsistent with the character of the neighborhood. But there's nothing in the record that indicates that the basis for this petition had anything to do with the aesthetics or with the visual impact of the tower. In fact, the only evidence of the basis for the petition was from the petition's proponent, who admitted at the hearing that it was not based on what the tower might look like. Now, this court has never held that community opposition can be substantial evidence irrespective of the basis or the foundation for the opposition. Inherent in the substantial evidence test is a requirement that the evidence relied upon be probative and that it be probative of something relevant. In this case, the county found that AT&T's application did not satisfy the criteria for a special exception. So the question is whether there is substantial evidence in the record probative of that issue, whether AT&T's application satisfied those specific criteria. Now, the community opposition that the county and the district court relied upon here.
Counsel, I think you would agree that fresh level for substantial evidence is not that high.
Well, it is overall a differential test, but there is a duty to the court to examine what is claimed to be evidence and to see to ensure that it's probative evidence of the pertinent question, of the relevant question. For example, even in the Nottoway case, and the court recognized that to be substantial evidence, it can't be concerns based on speculation or conjecture. So instead, there must be some foundation.
But they're looking at it as a reasonable legislator and not as a reasonable bureaucrat. So your argument that community opposition is not a really good basis is not well-founded, is it?
Well, I think it is, Your Honor. I think the question of the reasonable mind of a legislature is somewhat of a different issue. It's really the court duty to determine whether community complaints rise to the level of substantial evidence. Now, I think courts have recognized in the past that, you know, when it comes to wireless towers, there's quite a bit of not-in-my-backyard sentiment out there. And it certainly may be reasonable for local legislatures to yield to that. But Congress determined in Section 332 that the timely development of a reliable, high-quality national wireless network is too important to be held hostage to that kind of local sentiment, and that's why they impose the substantial evidence requirement.
What in the record do you base that they didn't base their decision on aesthetics, given how those towers were going to look?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the board's decision is based on aesthetics. The question is whether there's substantial evidence to support that decision. And the community opposition that the board relied upon and that the district court relied upon, most of it did not even go to aesthetics. And the court, for example, and the county have appointed this petition that 47 people signed, that the proponent admitted had nothing to do with the way the tower would look. Well, I'd submit that could hardly be substantial evidence that the visual impact of the tower would be inconsistent with the specific criteria governing the board's decision. In fact, that...
So you say the board could conclude that aesthetics militated against approval, but the board can't make that decision other than on the basis of evidence that others believe that aesthetically it wouldn't be consistent with the neighborhood. Is that what I just heard you say?
Well...
I think that's what I just heard you say.
Then I must have misspoke, Your Honor. I have two responses to that. One is that the board can make decisions based on aesthetics, but under Virginia law, and I think a prior decision of this court has recognized that, it can't be a purely subjective aesthetic opinion. It's got to be based on objective characteristics of the proposed, whatever the proposal is, it's got to be based on the objective characteristics. So,
the judge pointed out, and people may disagree about this, the appearance of the tree. I mean, we've all seen these tree pole type things, and they're pretty easy to pick out, but the district court judge pointed out, and I think the board noted, that it was substantially taller than the trees right around it, and how many of the residents who were in close proximity would be looking at it constantly. And those are all objective facts.
Well, those are objective facts. Again, I don't think, for example, in the petition from community opposition they relied upon, people were not objecting to the appearance of it. But if you look at the objective characteristics, the planning and zoning staff, they conducted a balloon test, and they found that this was screened from most points of view. And they found that it is an 88-foot structure disguised as what we call a monopine. but the trees in the area are between 40 and 100 feet. So it is consistent with the character of the area. And they found that there's only really a handful of places where it would be visible from. But even then, the staff found it would be from an oblique angle or blended in with 40 to 100-foot trees. And I think, even at the hearing, one of the board members who voted against it based on the objections from residents admitted that it was nicely disguised. And another one admitted that these fake trees, the plastic technology has come a long way in the last 10 years. Now, a couple of residents also said they thought the tower would be an eyesore.
How do you reconcile, or what is your understanding of the interplay between the substantial evidence standard on the one hand and your right to close a significant gap in coverage on the other? Maybe my question doesn't make sense. Is there any other federal statutory regime which on the one hand imposes a substantial evidence standard while at the same time creating a right in the regulatee other than the Telecommunications Act?
I'll admit offhand I can't think of one.
Right. Normally when we talk about substantial evidence review, we're talking about an administrative agency that makes a decision in favor of or opposed to a regulatee, and then judicial review is, as you say, very deferential, and as Judge Agee said, it's the most forgiving standard of review known to the law, pretty much. And yet in the Act, you have a right to come to court to show whether or not there's substantial evidence. In fact, there's an overriding consideration. Do I have that right?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's right. I think they are two different questions.
Are you going to address the second question, or do you think your strongest argument in this case is substantial evidence?
Well, I think they're both strong, Your Honor. I mean, we definitely address them both.
Well, before you, if you are going to leave the substantial evidence point, the board and the district court also focused considerable amount of attention on the deviation of the location of this particular pole from various provisions in the zoning ordinance and the comprehensive plan, and pointed out why there were inconsistencies between what the comprehensive plan proposed as a preferred location and how this would fit into that. That's something you haven't touched on yet.
Yeah, I think, Your Honor, there are a couple of problems with that. One is that I think the board has admitted that they did not vote to overrule the Planning Commission's determination that this would be consistent with the comprehensive plan. And I think that's a flaw under Virginia law. But second, even if the board...
I thought the board or the city council under Virginia law conducted a de novo review. It wasn't a process of whether they sustain or overrule the Planning Commission. It's a decision in the first instance by the highest local governing board of that locality.
Well, under the statute, the decision in the first instance for communications facilities and for a few other things, under 15.5-2232, the decision under Virginia law goes to the Planning Commission in the first instance to determine whether the placement of a telecommunications facility or a public utility facility is consistent with the comprehensive plan. And apart from that, the statute then says the board can vote to overrule or reject that recommendation. Now here, the board clearly voted to reject 18's application, but I think they've admitted they did not specifically vote to overrule the Planning Commission's determination. It was only after the fact, after litigation commenced, and they produced a written opinion where they first said, well, we've decided this doesn't comply with the comprehensive plan. Now that only goes to a couple bases of decision. The comprehensive plan requirements that basically express policy preferences for placements on existing facilities or on public lands. But here, the board did not, though they could have, theoretically, they can reject a carrier's application for being incomplete, saying you haven't provided enough information. Well, they didn't do that here. What they did is they came out with a written decision after the fact, and they said, well, we find that this doesn't meet these criteria. Well, the criteria express a preference for example, co-location on existing facilities if they are available. But the board doesn't point to any substantial evidence that there are any existing facilities available that AT&T could use here. I'd like to very briefly address the property value issue. The county and the district court also relied on the opinion of two residents that the property values would not be harmed here. But again, I submit that can't be substantial evidence because there's no foundation for those opinions.
Well, property owners can testify as to their opinion as to the value in condemnation cases. Why can't the court consider that in this situation?
Well, Your Honor, in the Nottoway case, the court said that concerns based upon conjecture or speculation lack probative value and will not amount to substantial evidence. Now, the difference between the concern that's based on conjecture or speculation and one that's reasonably founded is some sort of foundation. Now, here, if you look at the evidence in the record, it's simply a statement by two residents that, oh, we think this is going to hurt property values, but there's no indication of any foundation for that. And that distinguishes this case from, in a prior case, the court noted that there was a mortgage banker who specifically testified in his experience this would hurt property values. Now, the county seems to suggest that you don't need any any foundation here because the court can just assume that it's common knowledge that a tower would hurt property values. But I think the studies in the record refute any idea that this is a matter of common knowledge. The second issue in the appeal concerns the effective prohibition test under Section 332. And the district court found, first of all, that there could not be an effective prohibition because the county had allowed AT&T to place other facilities in the county. But we submit that misinterprets Section 332. Section 332 is not on its face limited to jurisdiction-wide prohibitions. but bans any state or local regulation that prohibits or has the effect of prohibiting the provision of wireless service, which is the ability of an end user to make a call. Now, if the county had expressly prohibited the provision of wireless service in half the county and said, we're only going to allow people to provide service in this half of the county, I don't think there's any question that would violate Section 332. And the result should be no different under the effective prohibition prong. If we've pointed out, a number of courts have held that Section 332 violated.
What's the difference in your estimation between, if any, among dead spots, service gaps, or coverage gaps, and significant coverage gaps? Is that taxonomy consistent with the law in this area?
Your Honor, I'm out of time.
Yeah, you used all your time on substantial evidence.
please respond to Judge.
I think, Your Honor, the way a number of other courts have looked at it is 332 on its face is not limited to jurisdiction-wide prohibitions on service, but they apply a background principle of law, the de minimis principle. And they say if it's a de minimis gap, then Section 332.
That's a dead spot, right?
Well, a small dead spot. You know, and it's based on the circumstances. You know, are we talking about thousands of people can't make calls from their homes, which is the case here, or is it, you know, a block here, or is this guy in this house here? And that would be a de minimis gap.
So you claim you have a significant gap?
Yes, I think the coverage map showed we had neighborhoods which stretched about a square mile and had hundreds of houses and maybe thousands of residents.
Okay, maybe you can come back to that in your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Ms. Gorey? Did I get that right?
Yes, Gorey.
Right.
May it please the court, my name is Laura Gorey. I represent the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors. And the board is requesting this morning that the court uphold the district court's November 10th, 2010 decision because the district court properly granted summary judgment in favor of the board, finding that the board's denial of the application was supported by substantial evidence in the written record and that it did not constitute a denial or a prohibition on the provision of personal wireless services. To pick up where the AT&T left off, in terms of prohibition on service here, AT&T had a very heavy burden of proof here, and the district.
What does that mean?
Well,
the cases do indeed talk about it's a heavy burden, it's a substantial burden. What does that actually mean in terms of the normal civil rules of proof? And can you address that? It's not a beyond a reasonable doubt, is it?
Well, Your Honor, as the Fourth Circuit so far has interpreted heavy.
Is it beyond a reasonable doubt?
I don't know exactly how it would play in with.
Is there any civil case anywhere that's ever applied a beyond a reasonable doubt standard of proof?
Well, it's whether not only this application was rejected, but any further efforts would be would not work, basically. And
I understand there are a couple of elements, but what is the burden of proof? What is the burden? You started out by saying it's a heavy burden, and I accept that.
Right.
What does that mean?
It means that. My interpretation of Fourth Circuit law is that AT&T has to show that this is the only place where it could have service. And it can't make that.
The only place.
Not only the only place, but that if it were to make any other attempts, that the board would not approve them.
Okay. Well, isn't it a two-part examination? First of all, whether there's a gap in service? Does the board concede here that there's a significant gap in service?
It is not my understanding from Fourth Circuit law that the Fourth Circuit analyzes the gap in coverage as an initial matter.
So you don't think we should? You don't think we have, and you don't think we should analyze whether there's a gap in service?
I think you could certainly look at that. And looking at AT&T.
Well, don't we have to look at that?
How
can we know whether? I don't understand how we have the choice not to look at that.
Well, I believe you would certainly have to look at it to determine whether this is the only site where they could provide coverage.
Well, first, there's a question of whether there is an absence of coverage. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, so, and do you agree with my taxonomy that there are dead spots, there are gaps that are not significant, and there are gaps that are significant?
I do believe that there's case law to that effect,
okay.
Yes.
All right. So, assuming there's a gap in coverage that's sufficiently significant that the law permits the provider to do something about that. Then we come to the question of whether, as you put it, there's another place where it could put the pole, right?
Correct. Any other location or combination of...
Okay. And so the case law uses the term whether it's fruitless to continue to try.
Correct.
Is that, you're familiar with that language?
Yes.
What does that mean?
That means...
That it's fruitless to continue to try.
Whether the applicant would have any success if it tried to locate in any other location or in any combination of sites.
Any success?
Correct.
Meaning, what does that mean?
Whether a board would approve any other combination or any other location for the site.
Okay. So let's go back to my original question.
Okay.
What is the burden on the wireless provider in the face of a denial when it comes to court? As Congress says, it can come to court, right? You agree
okay.
with that?
Yep.
And Congress has said, even if there's substantial evidence supporting the denial, there's a separate parallel analysis necessary, correct?
Right.
Okay, and so what's the burden on the wireless provider?
To show, as you have stated, that they don't have existing coverage, that they would have coverage through this site, and that they could not locate in any other place.
Okay. And is that by a preponderance of the evidence, clear and convincing evidence, or beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, I have not seen an analysis that attributes any certain proof standard to it.
Do you think such an analysis is necessary?
Well, I think thus far the Fourth Circuit has...
Fourth Circuit's never reversed the district court.
Right,
that,
there's an extremely
high burden. That denied a permit.
The highest burden that could be placed on the applicant, I think, is right now placed on the applicant.
And what is that burden?
A heavy burden.
A heavy burden.
Yes,
and
Your Honor.
Can you translate that into preponderance, clear and convincing, or beyond a reasonable doubt? That's what we talk about. When we talk about evidentiary burdens, we're talking about those three benchmarks, aren't we?
Judge Davis wants you to do an analysis the Fourth Circuit has never done, so you have a daunting task.
I do.
And perhaps an unanswerable task.
Right, and again, I just think it's the heaviest burden, and I didn't give this much thought because in this case, the coverage maps show
that... Because that law is pretty undeveloped, isn't it?
I think the law is pretty developed in terms of the burden. It's just that they haven't used the language of proof.
Is there any other series of cases where a court has said you have a heavy burden? Has a district court ever granted a motion for judgment because a party didn't meet its heavy burden?
I'm not familiar with any other line of cases, Your Honor, to that effect.
So you think that the service provider's got to provide evidence that there is no other place where it could possibly put the pole. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Or that the board would not approve any other place or combination.
So in other words, the provider's got to keep asking the board until the board essentially denies every possibility, and then the provider can come to court?
Or the board gives some sort of indication that it is not amenable to considering any other alternatives.
A blanket ban. In other words, we're not going to approve any further installations.
Or that there just aren't any other options, that not necessarily that the board wouldn't consider them, but that there just aren't any other options. And again, as the case law has stated, it's difficult to even conceive of such a situation where there's so many different ways in which service can be provided and so many different combinations.
Wouldn't the burden be on the provider in the first instance to, even if you assume there's an effective prohibition of coverage, whatever that would mean in the particular area, that the burden is on the carrier to come in, and certainly when it's apprised of other potential sites, to come in with some evidence as to why this won't work? And as I understand the facts in this case, there was a suggestion that locating in the Fort Hunt National Park was a possibility, and the carrier's response to that was, well, it might take too long. But that was about it, as I understand the evidence. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
As a follow-up to Judge Agee's question, what kind of evidence did AT&T put forward to demonstrate that there were no other feasible alternatives?
Well, AT&T referred to 9 separate locations. And those locations, it said, either were not available or did not meet its RF coverage thresholds. One of them was Fort Hunt National Park, where, as you have pointed out, Your Honor, they did not even apply to locate there. And a few other sites, they simply said that, again, they didn't meet the coverage thresholds, but there was no evidence that they looked at those as possibly that they could locate at multiple sites in combination. And the Fourth Circuit has held that an applicant is not necessarily entitled to the most cost-effective option. And here, because the board found that AT&T didn't even provide any evidence as to whether they could meet part of their coverage threshold there, they weren't satisfied with what AT&T provided. Further, there's technology that's been advanced, as discussed by the board during the board hearing, where they could have possibly located a distributive antenna system along a road, which has been successful in other areas, but there was no evidence as to whether that was looked at. There was also no evidence that, in terms of Fort Hunt National Park, that it wouldn't have satisfied the RF threshold in the park. They just simply extrapolated from another carrier's experience in national parks that it would take too long, but didn't apply in this case. But the coverage maps in this case do not show a gap in coverage. What they show, they do show a white area, but as stated in the briefs, that's simply because of the coverage threshold that AT&T chose to show. They chose not to show the on-street or the in-vehicle coverage. And that is by comparison with the T-Mobile coverage maps, which were also provided because T-Mobile was looking to co-locate at this tower. T-Mobile provided those maps and showed far more coverage. And so from that, one can presume that AT&T also has this level of coverage, and they haven't denied it. Rather, they have referred to other circuits where there's been some discussion of a carrier's right to whether or not it should be considered in building or in vehicle coverage. But notably, one of those cases, which I believe was OmniPoint Holdings, found that the Telecommunications Act does not guarantee a carrier the right to compete with landline services. And so in this case, they do not have a gap in coverage. Maps show that they already have 3 facilities in this site. Again, there were some other options that the board thought that they should have considered or looked at locating in a number in combination. And in terms of the declaratory ruling, AT&T did not raise their arguments about the declaratory ruling to the district court. And really, that ruling is only pertinent to the extent that a local authority has denied an application because of the presence of another carrier. But that's not the case here, where the evidence shows that AT&T itself has 3 sites in this immediate vicinity. And notably, some of the locations that AT&T said were not options, the reason they said they weren't options was because they were too close to the proposed site, which is further evidence that they already have coverage in this immediate vicinity. In terms of substantial evidence, as this court has stated, there's a very deferential standard that is given to a local board when making a zoning decision such as this one, and that the reviewing court doesn't reweigh the evidence or substitute its decision for that of the board, which is what AT&T seems to want the court to do in this case. It cites to other circuits which have held that you are to look at the record as a whole and consider the unfavorable evidence, but the Fourth Circuit has specifically said that you look at the record as a whole just to see if there's substantial support for the decision that was made. And here, the primary focus of the board and the district court's opinion was on the inconsistency of AT&T's application with the applicable zoning requirements. Now, AT&T contends that the board failed to overrule the Planning Commission's determination, but the Planning Commission, under 15.2.22.32, makes an entirely separate finding. Even the language of the statute is separate. They're supposed to find that the application is substantially in accordance with the comprehensive plan. Whereas under the zoning ordinance, the Board of Supervisors is required to find that a special exception application satisfies all requirements of the zoning ordinance. And the first general standard under 90061 is that the proposed use at the proposed location be in harmony with the comprehensive plan, which is different language.
By the way, Singular have a right of judicial review within the state court system in the Commonwealth, or was their right limited under the Act to the federal district court?
I believe they could have appealed to the state court. I don't know that, but because this is a federal statute, I think they didn't have, there was no intermediate level of review before appealing to the federal court.
Okay, so they couldn't have gone to circuit court in Fairfax County and sought judicial review of the denial?
We would have moved to remove it to federal court, I'm sure. Okay. So in terms of the board's determination that
apart from the is there a state law right separate and apart from the federal right here? Because frankly, I've been sitting here listening to all this discussion about substantial evidence, and I feel like, you know, I'm a member of the circuit court for Fairfax County. I mean, and I'm just trying to understand, is there a difference?
Well, I believe that in a case that doesn't involve the Telecommunications Act, when a board has just denied a special exception application,
right. That's all this was, right? Right? A special exception.
It was, except that the way that AT&T framed it was that it violated the federal Telecommunications Act.
That's the way they framed it in federal district court.
Correct.
My question is, before they went to court, did they have the option of going to Commonwealth Court within the system of Virginia, just as any other applicant for a zoning exception would?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. I misunderstood your question. So if they had not challenged, if they hadn't said that we violated the Telecommunications Act and simply challenged the special exception denial, then yes, they could have gone to state court first.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify that in my own mind. Yeah.
Yes, sorry, I apologize.
And I suppose they could have done both, theoretically at least, right? Not that you should split your cause of action and so forth, but
I guess theoretically, because they would be different challenges.
Right. Okay.
The board found
this really doesn't have to go to the merits, but it is a curiosity. Are you familiar with any cases where the telecommunications carrier has gone to state court purely on the zoning issue?
I am not, Your Honor.
It just makes me wonder whether if they did, you would raise a preemption defense, but that's not our case, so we're just delaying you from the rest of your argument.
I didn't see in any of the procedural history and the Fourth Circuit cases that anyone went to state court first, so I'm not aware of any. Your Honor, the reason that the board found this application was not in harmony with the comprehensive plan was actually a number of reasons. One, there's a directive to locate a directive against new structures, and here AT&T proposed not only a new structure, but an 88-foot tall structure that had a 15 by 27-foot shed. There was no evidence that they couldn't have located on an existing rooftop, utility pole, tower, a combination of those. They also proposed to have this new structure on private property, and this isn't just any private property. This is private property right in the middle of an R3 district, and it's also on property that already has a use that's not permitted by right. So the Masonic Lodge itself is not a permitted use there, and they were attempting to add an additional special exception use to that property. There's a preference under the comp plan for a public property, and again, they failed to even apply at Fort Hunt National Park. In terms of the adverse visual impact, the court found, because under Objective 42 of the Comprehensive Plan, the court is required to look at whether the applicant has minimized the visual impact. And that is not a matter of just aesthetics. The board is charged with regulating the size, height, and location of structures. But also under the comp plan, they look at whether the proposed site itself minimizes the impact of the visual impact. And this proposed site was covered almost completely with asphalt and concrete. It had 54 parking spaces. The closest tree was 30 feet smaller. Even the proposed supplemental plantings at their greatest height, their mature height, the tallest one would be 50 feet, and most would be much shorter than that. So this tree really towered over the existing landscape. So the board found that the application was not consistent with the first part of 90061, that it wasn't in harmony with the comprehensive plan. It also wasn't in harmony with the applicable zoning district regulations because of the lack of screening, imposing height, and prominence in the landscape. And finally, under 9006, the board was required to determine whether the use was harmonious with the development of neighboring properties and whether it would impair the value of adjacent land.
Would any of this matter at all if, accepting your statement of the test, if it were to turn out that this was the only location? Would any of this matter under federal law?
Well, because there are two inquiries, what I was just discussing, the substantial evidence, I think would be, there's still substantial evidence supporting the denial, but whether or not it would constitute a prohibition on service, if this really were the only site and there were no other sites, then it probably would constitute a prohibition, but that's
and
not
therefore
the case
none
here.
Of this would matter, right?
Well,
as a legal matter,
as a
it wouldn't matter.
As a legal matter, effectively, no, it okay. wouldn't.
And by the way, did you say earlier that, or did you suggest, or did you mean to suggest, that a wireless carrier doesn't have the right to provide adequate in-building service? You mentioned they can't compete, they're not supposed to be the same as a landline. And of course, that's non-controversial. But what is your understanding of what's not permitted in the way of prohibition of service in regard to in-building service?
I didn't mean to say that anything that determinative. The Fourth Circuit hasn't held any specific level of coverage. It does or doesn't constitute a prohibition. But no, I don't believe that there's any support in case law that lack of in-building coverage is a prohibition on service when there are existing sites under Fourth Circuit case law where there is existing coverage.
I see. So I guess I'm not clear. Is there no answer to the question? Is that your answer?
Well, I guess the answer is that
the Fourth Circuit hasn't said what a carrier is entitled to provide in building.
Right. The Fourth Circuit hasn't said, and the Telecommunications Act again is not a guarantee that mobile services can compete with landlines, and that would be right. So there is no specific answer.
Thank you.
You very much.
Thank you.
You've got some rebuttal time left.
Thank you. Shouldn't we demand more direct evidence that there are no other feasible sites than exist in this record?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, I think AT&T put on a prima facie case with its application and at the hearing that it had undertaken an exhaustive search for other sites. Most of the area
never inquired about the National Park Service, and we're 2 years into this litigation, so it's going to take too long. You might have that site now.
Your Honor, I think with AT&T explained at the hearing that not only do things take a long time with the National Park Service, but they are loath to allow anything in a national park. I mean, here we're talking about a historical Fort Hunt, and they don't like to put cell towers in those parks, and we explained that could take years just to get.
That's AT&T's representation. There's nothing from the Park Service or any other neutral authority
that
says for that park that there's going to be any problem with it.
Well, it was AT&T's representation based on experience, on the experience of carriers with dealing with the National Park Service, and there was no evidence to the contrary provided at the hearing.
So what does that prove about this park? I mean, there may have been very good reasons that other carriers had lengthy difficulties in other parks. There's not any evidence of that. I mean, you don't know any of those things.
Well, the evidence we explained at the hearing that first of all, the Park Service is not bound by Section 332 to act on these permits in a timely manner, the same way that state and local governments are. And we explained, or AT&T's representative explained at the hearing that when you submit an initial application, they take up to 6 months just to go through the first stage. And then if they are thinking about considering it, then you go to the second stage, which is a full environmental analysis, which is another 6 to 9 months, and you still don't have any indication of whether they're are amenable to allowing you to place something there. And the other point I would like to make about Fort Hunt National Park is the county's focus on putting facilities there is, I don't think, consistent with Section 332 itself. Now, Section 332 says the county may not effectively prohibit the provision of wireless service. Now, the county has no control. I mean, they do have control over, applications to place facilities in most of the county, but they have no control over whether the Park Service, the National Park Service, would allow the placement of a tower in a national park.
What do you think your burden is?
Preponderance of the evidence, Your Honor. Now, I mean, I think it's a heavy burden.
And what's your burden to show fruitlessness with respect to a possible future application?
Your Honor, I think...
Do you have to show that there's no other place other than the place you want?
No, Your Honor, I think in the 360 communications case, the court recognized that you know, the issue is whether service could feasibly be provided from only one site.
And what does that mean?
And we submit that that's a practical test based on the facts and circumstances of a particular case, not a completely hypothetical one. You know, for example, this site is in a technical, hyper-technical sense, of course, it's not the only site. We could move it 100 feet, 200 feet, one direction or the other into the neighbor's yard or into the other neighbor's yard. But, you know, considering that local governments have, I think under the FCC's declaratory ruling, 180 days to rule on an application, we can get maybe two a year. So, you know, we can go to the neighborhood lots and, you know, in 15 years, you know, the county has said, well, you can't put it in the 30 neighboring residential lots. And, you know, we're still at it. And we don't think that's an appropriate test, nor is it our burden to go through that kind of process. We think.
And by the way, does normal Rule 56 summary judgment standards apply in these cases?
I don't know I should say I'm not aware that any court has specifically ruled on that. And I would submit I don't see any reason they shouldn't. But I don't know that any court has specifically addressed that. And just back briefly to Fort Hunt National Park, the point I was making is I don't think under 332 that the county could effectively prohibit service within the area under its jurisdiction, saying we're not going to let you put anything up, but that's okay because maybe some federal agency will down the road, but we don't know. You know, the test under 332 is whether the county has effectively prohibited service. And I don't think, you know, pointing to some area that's beyond their control overcomes that. And I believe I'm out of time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the argument of counsel. We're both somewhat at a limited disadvantage. Judge Davis and I had the opportunity to sit on a case last term involving T-Mobile in Fairfax County, and that opinion has not been filed yet, and that may resolve some parts of the issues here, but anything that could help you today. But we'll come down now and greet counsel and then move on to our next case.